Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had the taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Refreshes me. So this is good. How are you?
I'm good. It's my birthday week, so I've had like an unusual amount of social interaction, so I'm feeling really drained.
Well, happy birthday, but also my sympathies on the draining. As an introvert myself, I can understand. Crowds are difficult.
Yeah, no, I love them all. I love everybody, but, like, I've just, yeah, it's exhausting for me. So you know, I went to Seattle on Sunday, you know, and hung out with people, and then on Monday I had dinner with people, and then on Wednesday I did a paint and sip night with other people, and then tomorrow I had date night tonight, so that was, you know, that, and then tomorrow I have some of my friends throwing a house party for birthday. So I'm just kind of like, I'm not going to talk to anybody.
Aren't you popular? All right. After this, you'll just have to sleep for a week and just, like,
yeah.
Be antisocial. Yeah. I'm like that. I'm like, mm-hmm. I'll have one weekend of, like, super fun, and then I'm like, now leave me alone for a month.
yeah.
But no, that is, it's nice that so many people care. We do have a caller, so I'm going to invite them on. They've been holding. I suspect this is Bill, but it could be anyone. So welcome, caller. Please introduce yourself.
Hi. Hi. As a matter of fact, this is Bill. How are you tonight?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm just listening, and I do mean really thank you. Thank both of you for volunteering your time to do the work you do and keep poetry at the forefront of people's thoughts and minds, which we is so much better than so much of the news I've been watching today. All this political stuff, it's just nice to think about poetry for a while.
It is. I need my poetry breaks for sure. I still my life with poetry. So that's, I'm happy that we can do that for other people too. Now,
it's an important thing.
It is. It is. I'm
some of us don't have house parties to go to. That kind of fun.
I rarely do, I have to say.
Well, that's part of it, too, is, like, it's been so long. Like, I haven't been to, like, a house party in at least 10 years, if not longer. So, and when your friend tells you to throw one for your birthday, you don't just be like, no. So, and I'm not complaining. Like, I'm excited about it, but I'm also just kind of tired.
It'll be fine. And, I mean, it's your thing, so you can be in charge. You can be like, and you're done. Or have a spot to hide. I always have, like, a backup plan of, like, this is my little introvert corner where I will hide with, like, their pet or something, and that's what I do.
Because I'm a weirdo
like
that. Because they know me. So they've already cordoned
off
a room for that.
That's perfect. Okay, I like these people. Babbler's friends,
I went
have
to a
my
party
approval.
One time, and not long after I got there, I just went into another room and sat on the couch and went to sleep. And then people got mad at me for doing that, and I thought, you're better off that I went in there to sleep rather than forcing me to stay around you all. They didn't really see it that way. I'm probably just not hanging with the kind of fun people that you will have.
Yeah, I really only go to 2 parties a year, and they're thrown by the same person, and he has, like, all of the best nerdy friends, and I happen to really love nerdy people. And so it's like I'm not the dork at the party because everyone is. but also he has, like, this little swing set thing, like, in the backyard away from everything, so, like, if it's getting too loud, I just go out on the swings, and nobody cares.
I go to a party with a bunch of nerds. They just want to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I do that, too. Actually, it's been a while. Our group kind of fell apart, but now I lead it at work for the kids. I have a kids' Dungeons & Dragons group. I'm the dungeon master, and it's actually like super fun being in charge. I was really nervous about not just being one of the players, but I'm killing it.
Very nice.
Because the kids don't know any better, and I'm like, roll for me, you die.
What kind of character do you have?
You die.
Well, I'm not a character. I'm just a narrator right now. But previously,
oh,
I
so
was
you're
the bard.
Dungeon master.
I am the
you're
dungeon
master.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the most fun role, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it would be, but it is. I like it. I'm totally winging it to you. I don't have a proper campaign, but it's fun. Anyway, let's get to our poetry, and let's start with yours, Bill. I've put it up on the board in Late Night Poets so people can read along. You can go ahead and read when you're ready.
All right, just a moment. Let me pull it up here. Okay, and I should thank, I hope I pronounced this right, Aphasiana. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I wanted to say thank you because you gave such a great prompt. It forced me to think a little bit. I was thinking of the light, a character who would be in the light and in the dark. So I had to stretch my imagination a little bit. And I'm always grateful for anyone who inspires me to do that. So this is a poem called Rebecca the Teenage Vampire. And it goes like this. The insufficiency of intention can morph into mature discipline. Rebecca was a teenage vampire raised far beyond convention. Stalking sidewalks at night, she cursed the passing car headlights. Still, Rebecca's mind was deeper than a grave, her thoughts cut sharper than any wooden stake. With more question than suspicious strife, Rebecca savored consideration of the if at center of her life. Bitten by her best friend in a bathroom stall, Rebecca struggled to resist the gloom of midnight's call, for instead of blood, she preferred spaghetti and meatballs. The coffin offered no comfort. She gave up books for bats. When human victims couldn't be found, she took to catching cats. Yet some dangers in the dark don't always delight in what they do. Rebecca missed the witness of dawn. She missed her true friends from school. The older vampires imagined Rebecca was too foolish to understand. An eternal life is something mere mortals can only hope to command. When Rebecca's hands transformed to wings, she took to flight with all the fury of a storm. Just you wait until tomorrow, Rebecca warned with hiss. She wrote a last letter to the vamps. You'll miss me when I'm gone. She spent her last night locked in a room, then woke up to greet the dawn. From vampire to vapor, Rebecca became one infused with sun rays. For even vampires can decide to refuse dark for a brand new day. That's Rebecca the Teenage Vampire.
Great read. Thank you. And this
Thank you.
Interesting.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. You're welcome. Appreciate you calling in to read it too. I like to hear poetry in the voice of the author. I think it adds an extra element to it to hear it how it was intended to sound. I thought this was a really interesting story that you wove, you know, like the vampire that didn't want to be a vampire even from the beginning, you know, just bitten by her best friend in a bathroom stall. You know, and from the beginning of it, it sounds like struggling, you know, missing meatballs. I like that in particular, you know, instead of blood, she preferred spaghetti and meatballs, you know, and giving up books for bat, and just not really adapting to this, you know, not like embracing what it is to be a vampire, and deciding not to. You know, to in the end, just deciding, you know, this isn't really for me, and this is the sunrise. Spent her last night locked in a room and woke to greet the dawn. From vampire to vapor, Rebecca became infused with sun rays. For even vampires can decide to refuse dark for a brand new day. And I think, you know, that reads a little bit deeper even than the story, you know, obviously. You can choose to go the path of light even when you're surrounded by the dark. You know, which adds, I think, depth to the story. I did also really like the line, Rebecca favored consideration of the if at the center of her life, if being literally at the center of life. I thought that was really creative wordplay that you did there. And I've never really noticed the middle of life as if. So,
if is in the middle of life.
It is. The big if. If with some bookends. So I really enjoyed it. Thank you for the write. Ephesiana, what
well,
do you think?
I will say there's a little something cathartic in it for me because I'm much older today, but when I was a lot younger, I can remember going to too many of those house parties and being out all night long and making a fool of myself and drinking and whatnot. And so it used to be that when you would see the sun starting to come up, you would know, oh my God, the party's over now, because morning is coming and that means work or responsibilities. And somehow the light of day just suddenly reminds you of the ass that you made of yourself during the night. So seeing the sun come up just overwhelms you with this sense of dread, knowing that it's going to shine a light on all of this sin from the night before. And so I'm one of those people who used to drink a lot and whatnot, but I've been sober for more than 12 years now. And one of the best things that I've been able to experience from all of that is having my mornings again and not being full of dread when I see the sunrise. I can watch the sunrise with a clear conscience. Does that make sense?
It
yeah.
does.
Yeah. No, I
like
mean, I'm not a heavy drinker, but I'm still not a morning person. But, you know, if you've been up all night partying and the light comes out and you got to go to work, I've certainly lived through that. You know, and if you didn't make an ass of yourself, you feel like ass because you didn't sleep at all.
That's one of the hard things about getting old. Is remembering all the stupid things you did when you were younger. Oh, I'm sorry.
Really only had that one summer of being pretty stupid, but I do remember looking at my makeup in the morning and thinking how ridiculous it looked, like, you know, when the eyeliner like melted down and like that. I was just like, oh, it's not so pretty in the sunlight, is it?
Oh, I remember you. We met one night. Are you the girl in Seattle?
No. Although I'm probably a kindred spirit. I loved the part in this that Babbler pointed out, the if at the center of life. I think that's really clever. I've never thought about it that way, but it's a great line. I also like how her mind is deeper than any grave and her thoughts cut sharper than any wooden stake. You play on a lot of the main, you know, tropes of vampires, recognizing like the coffin and the connection to the bats and all of that, but it weaves into a story that's really well done and reminds me a little bit of Louis in the Introduced Vampire, because he was very reluctant to be a vampire at first. Didn't want to kill. And she seems hesitant into the lifestyle, and then you know, chooses not to give in to that the darkness of her situation. And you know, it's unfortunate that she has to end herself to do that, but it's there's always a choice. Not always good choices. There are not always good options, but there's a choice. And I liked the alliteration of vampire to vapor. It had a nice sound to it. Because it's not just that they both have V's, they both have the P to vampire to vapor. Had a nice sound to it. Well done.
Thank you. I might just be waiting too much for What We Do in the Shadows to come back on TV.
You know, I haven't watched that yet, but I've heard good things. I've heard very good things.
It is hilarious.
I used to be obsessed with Angel back in the day when I was a kid. I was obsessed with Angel. I watched it before Buffy, which is totally backwards. You're supposed to watch Buffy and then Angel is a spinoff. I watched Angel, and it was more serious than Buffy. Like, it was less campy to a certain degree. And I loved it, and then I eventually watched Buffy. But it's just, I see them as separate entities. But I was, honestly, I was probably too young when I first watched it to fully, like, grasp things that happened. And then later I watched it as an older person, and I was like, oh, yeah. But, yeah, vampires.
I love Buffy.
Can be them. I'm sorry.
Love Buffy.
I mean, it definitely has its moments.
I mean, my dog's name is Rupert Giles.
Oh, I love Giles.
So,
I'm a librarian, and in library school, everyone
I remember some of those characters from Buffy, but What We Do in the Shadows, what's so cool about it, the vampires live together like a bunch of kids in a college dorm, but, I mean, they have, it's a house. And so you have these three very traditional vampires, but then there's this one who's named Colin Robinson, and he looks like he's one of those characters like Dwight Schrute from The Office. And Colin, he's, you know, one of those little bald, nerdy guys with the glasses, the black glasses, and the pen case in his shirt pocket. But he's not like the regular vampires in that he has to go around biting people on the neck. His whole shtick is the way he drains people of their energy by boring them to death and just coming up with things like someone might say, "Hi, Colin, good morning, how are you doing?" And he'd say, "Well, I'm fine, except I've been having this little ache in my knee. I think it may have something to do with the shoes I'm wearing. Can you see these? I bought them at they had a sale, so I decided to buy these shoes. But now they're hurting my heel. So when I walk, it's bothering my knee, and I think I'm going to have to go to the podiatrist." And it just goes on and on. And the more he talks, he's draining the energy out of his victims, and that's how he does it, by just boring them to death. Sorry.
That's brilliant.
I might be doing the same right now. Sorry.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll have to check
it
out.
Me too.
Where are we off
going
to
on my to-watch list? Now we have one by Victoria Frost. And this was actually from a contest that I had that was not for this show. It was for a music group that I'm in. But I just loved it so much that I had to share it on the show. So this is Victoria Frost with Paper Dolls.
pushing up daisies from the coffin clothes. I'll leave on my trust a single red rose. Let my gray headstone sink in the ground. Cause when I needed love, you weren't around. I didn't matter, you didn't see the way my demons always haunted me. So now you're crying, but it's too late. My words are left in crimson drops of hate.
Wow.
Yeah. I just love Victoria's audios. So this was for a contest that I had where I gave everyone the music, and they all, to the same music, wrote different songs. And I just thought it was wonderful. I loved the way that she talked about the paper wrinkles and paper cuts that go unseen. You know, there's all these things that are behind the masks that people wear, where you don't realize the pain they're in. You don't realize who they really are below the surface. I like, you'll make a pretty mask and hide your own exposure. It really works with, like, the feel of the music, because it's, like, eerily upbeat. It's a happy kind of sound, but at the same time, it's a little bit creepy. And I think that she really captured that well, and that was part of the challenge, was to make the music work with your lyrics. Push up the daisies as the doors close and spill your pain in paper roses. I think it's brilliant, you know, pushing up daisies being that saying, and the way that she captured it was so great. And the end, my words are left in crimson drops of fate. She matches her style and her subject matter, and she makes it so smooth. Like, I could listen to it over and over and over again, and I love Victoria's audios. She got bronze in this contest. She could have easily won gold, but there was a lot of amazing entries in that contest. It was so hard to choose, but I mean, like, it's something that would be worthy of gold. It was almost a three-way tie. So yay, Victoria, you're awesome. Bill, what did you
think? You really used the right word earlier when you said brilliant. And I, beyond the writing, I have to just start with the music. And you won't know what a compliment this is because you don't really know me. But I'm very critical with respect to music, and I like what I like, and I'm not familiar with a lot of new stuff just because I refuse to hear it. But this was wonderful, and it somehow reminds me of Danny Elfman. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Danny Elfman is the musician who comes up with all the tunes that you hear in Tim Burton movies. You know, the guy behind Edward Scissorhands, The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's what the music in itself, it does have that eerie quality, as you mentioned. There's an ominous quality that is not so dark that it doesn't have a little fun interspersed within it as well. So it's not so dark that it's completely haunting. There's little tones of hilarity in it too. And, you know, so the beat and that music was, and I'm just trying to imagine the challenge of what it would be to be delivered that bit of music and come up with the lyrics that she did, which are just, like, brilliant again. But one of the things that immediately impresses me is how, I don't know if other people can see this as it's laid out here, but it's a rather longish bit of writing. With, I don't know, let's see, 1, 2, 3, what is it, maybe 9 or 10 stanzas. But despite that length, everything is so consistent. And it's reinforcement of the idea. And it, no stanza, I don't see any lines that stray from the central theme, which is kind of hard to continually do in a poem of this length. So there's brilliance on all kinds of different levels here. And, I mean, the assonance, the meter. And it's not, you know, real elevated language. This is stuff that is easy to follow. You don't have to read between lines. It's not so obscure that you're thinking, what does that mean? Am I getting this? You know, it's, you know, I mean, I like ambiguity, but sometimes it's just a little too much. None of that is going on in this poem. It's very clear to understand, to follow. There's a simplicity that just makes all of this masterful. I'm very impressed with the writing and whoever did the music, whoever created that music is quite the tunesmith as well.
And thank you for pointing that out, because I should say who did the music. So that was Tuna, spelled T-U-N-N, capital A, and No Bias. So they make beats. They post them on YouTube, and you can use them for free as long as you're not charging money to sell your music that you make with them. Tuna and No Bias, they have some really cool beats.
I'm going to check that out.
Babbler, what did you think?
Well, I really appreciated Victoria's voice. You know, the song was very lilting, and that haunting minor key, I think, really did a great job of, like, conveying that kind of creepy tone that you guys both mentioned. But then on top of that, you know, the what it's saying, you know, about, you know, pretending everything is okay and hiding what's actually going on. And it's really kind of interesting because it's like, you know, they don't see, no, they won't know the way the paper wrinkles as I go. You know, like the pain that I'm in is completely hidden. Nobody's noticing it because they just see this doll-like image that I put on the surface. And yet it's almost kind of a lure too, you know, like, hey, you should join us in putting on this facade, you know. It feels almost a little bit cult-like. And then yet later, there's this lament of nobody understanding you. You know, no one will listen, no one will hear. No, they don't care to see all of your tears. And yet, who's really responsible for that, you know? If you're always pretending like everything's okay and saying everything's okay, can you blame other people for not knowing that you're not okay? You know, it's kind of interesting, and I think that the lilting tone kind of helps with that too, because it's like, oh, now you're crying, but it's too late. You know, you two are like hiding your actual pain, and when you do that, you make it so that nobody can hear you, nobody can understand, because you're deliberately hiding it. So I thought it was really interesting because there's really kind of two facets to this, you know, the sadness that nobody understands you, but also all of the effort that goes into pretending everything's okay. You know, it's really more of a warning than it is, you know, like you're not actually trying to get people to do this, because at the same time as you're convincing them, you're showing them all the reasons why it's a bad idea. I really liked it. I thought it had a great message. The sound was wonderful. I liked her use of empty space. Like, she didn't every second of the song with lyrics. She really paced herself and put in, like, blank beats that I think really helped. I loved this. I thought it was really well done.
Well said. You both had great comments. Babbler, I think
I might add a quick thing. I want to piggyback maybe on something Babbler pointed out, because it was – such a valid point that she raised when, you know, and sure enough, the girl that sang this, she does have a very hypnotic quality to her voice, which melds
perfectly with the repeating theme in the writing, which was "Come with me, come with us, join us," as if someone trying, like Babler said, lulled, I think is the word. It has a lulling, trance-like feel to it of someone trying to hypnotize someone else. What do vampires call it? The glimmer? She's got a glimmering quality to her voice. And I do think that there's one of my favorite things in a good poem, I like for it to have a moral or a grand summation of some sort. And there is a cautionary tale in this of how someone can try to present this idea of togetherness. You join us. Come with me. Come with us. Become part of us. But, you know, we can get so caught up in the hypnotic nature of that union and not realize what a frightening thing we're becoming part of. You know, so we have to be wary of who's trying to hypnotize us, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And that is sort of the moral of what feels like a cautionary tale at overarching through all of this. Anyway, I'll shut up now. That's my take.
It's a good take. Now I'm going to get Babler to read Cherry Cola.
All right. This is my poem, Cherry Cola. This was written to my contest titled Magenta, which are poems inspired by the color magenta. So it goes like this. Tenor notes in an unfamiliar color, foreign to the back of my spine. Preteen body spread out across a rumpled comforter, imbued with the smell of wood smoke from days before the trailer. Limbs dangling over the edge, eyes peering into the back of my skull. Another stupid love song that reads like con man's lips, mouthing, "It's worth it," begging her to buy in. Only Darren Hayes is gay, so I guess it was a hymn. Or maybe it was a metaphor. I didn't care to find out. Yet it was the third time in a row wasted on the B-side. Glasses already tinted molasses on the edge of eighth grade. Screwdriver in my hand because a knife felt too dangerous. Its blade whispered in permanent, sweet nothings hidden in a blood droplet, winking beneath Norwegian skin. Red isn't a primary color. Just another shade of Avon sample piled in the corner with my mom's withering dreams. Tracing lines in the carpet, neon tucked in mauve. Maybe magenta is a shade I could wear one day if I dared to find out. End poem.
Great read and wonderful poem, Babler. You have like an amazing way of setting setting of a story. I can feel the time period and the place where you are, imbued with the smell of wood smoke from the days before the trailer. Now, maybe partly because I know that you grew up in a trailer park, I can just think of how the wood smoke reminds you of the place before that current place, maybe the time before your dad died when you had something a little bit more comforting, although I know it wasn't perfect before then either. But you set things with something like that before the trailer. And then you have the samples. Just another shade of Avon samples piled in the corner with my mom's withering dreams. Now, that is an amazing line. First of all those little, like, collection of the samples, it gives a setting of, poverty to a certain extent because you can't afford the actual lipstick, so you keep the little stubby things they give as samples, which I totally did too. No judgment there. and this is how I had makeup when I was young. Just samples. But recognizing that you don't have the primary colors, you just have the shades of samples. The way that you describe it too, because a knife felt too dangerous, its blade whispered in permanent sweet nothings, hidden in a blood droplet, winking neath Norwegian skin. So there's that scary temptation to self-harm, which we're too, like, I read your poems and I'm like, oh my God, flashback. But then deciding that you're going to use a different kind of red to decorate yourself and, like, maybe consider the Avon samples. But the way that it's piled in the corner with my mom's Withering Dreams, it's like not only is it just the Avon samples that she's saving, it's they're off in the corner. She's not going to put makeup on and go out because she's depressed. She's going to stay, curled up and not go out and not need that makeup. And it's there with her withering dreams and not being used. And that is, like, tragic on so many levels. But you word it in a way that's somehow, like, flowing and lighter than it could be. Like, it's still dark, but it's palatable dark, if that makes sense. A shade I could wear one day if I dared to find out. And, that's, again, potentially two things. So daring to find out, you're talking about earlier potentially cutting with the blade, and daring to find out, you're talking about maybe wearing makeup and going out into the world and exploring that side of yourself. So it's just, there's so many possibilities, and you create this vision. I can picture, like, the floor and the carpet and the wallpaper of this place, because you build it up so much with it's a fairly brief poem, but it's vivid in my mind. Maybe partly because I've read lots of your poems, but it's I'm building a view of your trailer in my mind, and I think you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
Rambling now. Bill, what did you think?
Yeah. Let me confess first that I only recently started reading Babel's poetry, and I've based on what I've seen before and now this, I realize there's this incredible talent she has to get into the minds and lives of these characters she creates, and now hearing her voice tonight for the first time and her little giggles, I realize that actual human is not anything like these characters that she, I don't think she's anything like these characters, but I've read in some of the other works that I've read of Babbler's, I'm just impressed how she's able to get into the minds and hearts of these people she creates. And, I find that sometimes that they are stuck in this sort of emotional, self-deprecating vortex, or stuck in some unhealthy interactions with other people, environments. I see that coming through some of her work, and it makes me, I remember the other day I read something and I had to tell her, thank you for ruining my day. It made me so depressed. I guess that's another
aspect of real talent when you find it is you don't just read the words, you feel them. And let me say, I'm not Darren Hayes, but I can get a lot of what you're saying here, because I was raised by a single working mother and sisters. So, you know, the whole idea, I can remember experiences in my family where I'm watching them put their makeup and stuff on, and should I wear this nail polish? Should I wear that mascara? Maybe one day when I feel more brave, you know, they'll explore these other colors. So these final lines, as a shade I could wear one day if I dared to find out. You know, as a man, it's kind of hard sometimes to relate to all the struggles that you girls go through to put that face on that you show to the world. And I can feel some of that coming across in this writing. And I think you touched on it a moment ago, but the whole idea of taking something precious as a blood drop, or blood droplet in this case, and reducing it to something so trivial as not just a shade or a sample, but even cheaper, an Avon sample at that. How low do you go? Avon. Is that even around still anymore?
Babble,
you're
so.
Not that old. Do they do Avon still?
I haven't seen it in a while. But I haven't gone looking for it either. I don't think I'm the demographic.
No, I don't think they go door to door, but I think they probably still have, like, it's one of those things that everyone tries. Now lip sense is the thing. I think lip sense is the next generation of Avon, because instead of doing it, like, in person, that everyone has, like, these little lip sense parties where you go try on your shades, except, oh, you tried it on, so you bought it. And that's a $50 lipstick. Everyone's trying to sell me lip sense.
I remember when the Avon lady used to come around knocking on the doors like the Jehovah Witnesses, but she would always have these samples. And, you know, my sister would always want to, like, spray it everywhere and say, smell this, sticking her hand in my nose, and I'd want to gag, you know, but again, getting back to the point, I mean, reducing blood down to something so trivial and finding just the perfect trivial thing, and bringing up the shade of a Navon sample. I get that. And it's piled in the corner with my mom's withering dreams. And somehow that resonates with me, too. I didn't grow up in a trailer, but I can remember my mother's piles in corners of certain rooms. And again, Babbler, just the idea, the way you make these scenes, the environment so vivid with your descriptions, and you get into the mind and hearts of these people that you write about. I just am so impressed.
Yeah, thank you. A lot of stuff that I write is autobiographical. It's not always completely autobiographical, but largely. And I'm just going to make one note here, just because the inspiration for this song, while it was the color magenta, it was also based on a, oh gosh, my brain all of a sudden is, a Savage Garden song called Cherry Cola that was very popular when I was in middle school. And they talk about the color magenta. So just in case people wonder how it's related to magenta. So, but thank you so much for the lovely comment. I really appreciate it.
Who was the band that you mentioned that you said it inspired this somewhat?
Savage Garden. And Darren Hayes is the lead singer.
They were the first band that I danced to, like, in middle school, too, it would have been. Truly, Madly, Deeply, first song I ever danced to, like, slow dance with a boy.
That was my first choir solo, singing that song.
You've lost me now. I have no idea what this music is. But
that's all right. You probably don't want
it to.
It's 90s pop.
I take it it came out sometime after the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think those may have been those years when I was running around and just tuned out of everything.
Yeah.
So I'm not even familiar with that. And I would only be interested in listening to that music now because you referred to it and they had some role in helping you create this. That's that would probably be the only redeeming thing I would find in them because I don't like most modern music.
All right.
Yeah,
I'm going to
be just because of the era in which they were popular. So it's one of those things that you know because of the zeitgeist and not because of a particular, like, music taste, you know? Like, I was the right age at the right time for this song.
Same. All right. Our next poem is Become Shadow, Become Gold by Ben Hart. Heathens. Heathens, welcome God among you. Pound your drums, pound your chests, hum for the coming of the blessed. God is here, in his favorite of churches, among his children dear, in a field of black heather burning, in a dress made of roses. He walks through ragged ivory crowds and places a petal into beggars' hands from which they can grow their own. His hair, braided into many tails, on which serpents suckle like a child and their thumb, aching feet marching down the path of nails to the numb thump of the drums. Their humming makes drunks of them all, and he stops when he thinks to catch in apologetic eyes a fleeting glimpse of the morning star before the fall, but any evidence he doesn't find in lingering. The trembling galaxy he finds behind magenta eyes lays the weight of human judgment upon the shoulders of the judge. Except for one woman who decides for herself she should not, perhaps because she was not of his creation. In a sunny dandelion dress at the altar of ash and smog, he watches her wilt into summer snow and like a bad dream drift away at waking. He takes a moment to breathe as the flames freeze on the fields and the plumes of smoke slow into statues. He looks past the pagan priests, past Saints Peter and Matthew, past black rabbits running into white wolves' mouths, past lonely sun setting over sullied south, praying for a light to appear, for something to show on his soul's telescope, fixed so firmly on the abysmal plains of hope, for a thrumming to reach his aching ears, but all he heard were the same violent echoes. Let me die, please, dear starry eyes. You have to let me go. Let me become shadow, become gold. He thought of letting go. Follow her, to whatever plane beyond pain she had chosen to roam, become a shadow of no obstruction, at one with dark, without light, without home. But then he felt the weight of a welcome touch of a weary, sunk shoulders. "You look ridiculous, Dad, just like Mom would have wanted." Someone who had been away whispered across the abysmal plains of hope. And for the first time in forever, he looked up to the new king of the temple's smoke. One by one, he let reality return. The sun, the wolf, the saints, the flames, watching the black heather burn, he reminded himself of everyone's names, as not to weep before getting to the grave, otherwise he'd never get through the day. The weight of a hand remained, but he was afraid it wouldn't be who he wanted it to be. And God was glad when he asked, "Did you really think I wouldn't come, Dad? How long do you think it was that you cast me? How low do you think it was that you cast me? Was I wrong, son, to ask suffering from us all, from all of us?" He put his hand on his son's and said, "I missed you, Lucifer. You look good in magenta, better than all the others, like one of those punk princesses. Now let's go bury your mother and get out of these ridiculous dresses." End poem.
This one was wild and fun. It starts out feeling like an old school sermon. You know, "Heathens, heathens, welcome God among you." Like, yeah, you can picture the church. You know, one of those large churches, the big congregations, you know, where it's almost more of a theatrical thing than it is actually about religion. You know, his favorite of churches among his children dear, in a field of black heather burning. And that's our kind of twist. It's like, okay, why are they in this burning field, you know? And you're painted this really wild character, you know, in a dress made of roses. He walks ragged. He walks through ragged ivory crowds and places a petal in beggars' hands from which they can grow their own. You know, it almost feels like a reworking of the parable about fish, you know, the fishes, you know, to give them something where they can grow their own. But then at the same time, it's like, grow their own what? Their own flowers? Like, how? So they just all run in flower stands now? Or is it for, like, an actual dress? Like, and again, you know, how, you know, limited usability there. So I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, and then his hair braided into many tails on which serpents suckled like a child and their thumb, you know. And then again, if you take this in that biblical religious context, you know, the serpents, the snakes, you know, whispering the words of Satan, you know, they're generally painted as an evil character. And yet to suckle like a child in their thumb, you know, just really fascinating, because to make it like infantile and innocent and yet use the symbol of what means not innocent, I think was a really creative and interesting usage. All of this interesting, you know, painting, I think, of Lucifer, you know, as walking around, bedecked out, like just, you know, looking like something out of, I can't think of the right thing, but just, you know, wildly flamboyant looking. And then to, you know, lay the weight of human judgment upon the shoulders of the judge, you know, to then think about all of the sinning and who is responsible for that. And except for one woman who decides for herself she should not. Like, is that Eve, I think, maybe? You know, because she was not of his creation. But that, you know, I just find this really interesting, and I'm looking for, like, all the metaphors and the meanings of things. I like that this one woman, though, it's just like, nope, not me. I'm not doing that. That judge thing, mm-mm. It's just full of really interesting characters and imagery. It's so vivid and bright. And then it feels, again, like something very much like a parable. And then you get to, you look ridiculous, Dad, just like Mom would have wanted. You know, and then it makes me think that it's kind of like more about funerals and forgiveness and moving on, moving past things, you know, to be brought back to reality, and to be able to move forward, by reconnecting with, you know, a child, you know, the son. So I thought this was really fascinating, you know, especially again when you get to that end stanza again. I missed you, Lucifer. You look good in magenta, better than all the others. Like one of those punk princesses. Now let's go bury your mother and get out of these ridiculous dresses. It makes it feel, you know, maybe it's about accepting someone who doesn't maybe behave the way you want them to, but you forgive them because time is limited. You know, it's like a retake on Lucifer and a retake on the prodigal son and a retake on, you know, accepting, you know, nonconformity, you know, maybe homosexuality, maybe just, you know, wearing clothing that's not, you know, gender conforming to societal norms. There's some really interesting things in here that it could say, you know, but to wear like bright pink dresses to a funeral, you know, in itself is fun. So it's interesting, you know, it's almost like a reconnection with someone who you disconnected with through death, which can happen. The opposite could also happen, unfortunately. Sometimes people get real crazy around death. But I enjoyed it. The imagery was great. The parables were interesting. I loved the change in tone, how this went from, like, classically religious, you know, like that kind of showboat religious, to something more whimsical feeling in the middle. More colorful, and then at the end, something more real, you know, more mundane. So I really enjoyed it. Great, right, Ben? So your thoughts?
Yeah, it was, I mean, you said something a moment ago, which seems so profound. The idea of Lucifer is the prodigal son. That just strikes me as ironic and funny. But, you know, as I read this, of course, it's not about me, but I have to just confess I'm so jealous because I find sometimes that so much of what I'm doing just falls into these familiar patterns and rhyme schemes. And for all that's here, the writer didn't fall into that. Everything stands on its own, and it's not rhyming, but there's this wonderful meter and rhythmic nature to it, which I think is born of the assonance, which is this, repetitive aspect of sound. It's not rhyme, but you all know what assonance is, and it's all throughout this, and it helps give it this rhythmic quality. But and I think you touched on so much that I would say, but you're reading along and just following it and getting immersed in it, and then all of a sudden there's these sort of side conversations that just snap you out of all that you've been reading and force you to suddenly pay attention. You look ridiculous, Dad. Was I wrong, son? These questions that just suddenly blurt from out of the lines, and I find the impact of that very commanding. And I didn't find so much a religious connotation as you were inferred, but what came across was this sense of superiority. And
as one, intoxicated in their own sense of authority. And that was, I think, a very good way to immediately draw you in, because you have this superior acting figure commanding you to heed what I'm about to say. So it automatically draws you in. And when I get to the end of this, I never would imagine that there was any kind of tenderness that one could imbue with the idea of Lucifer. But when he says, I've missed you, I've missed you. I mean, there's kind of a sweetness and tenderness to that that seems so much antithetical to what we would traditionally think of in an interaction between Lucifer and another. And for all the heaviness of what comes before, those final lines offer this incredible sense of relief and almost, I think for me, it was a bit humorous. Let's go bury your mother. Let's get out of these dresses. That just really brings it all home. And as I read that, it kind of reminds me of the story. You know, before Charles Manson was Charles Manson, one of the things he had to endure as a kid, his father would make him go to school wearing a dress. No wonder the guy ended up as he did. But there's a this poem is stellar. That's the main thing. There's a darkness, yes, but there's a feel of sentimentality to it as well, and a tenderness. How you get all of those elements packed into this one thing is a mastery to me.
It's definitely impressive how he got it all in there. And I felt like it had an energy to it, like pound the drums and pound your chest and hum for the coming. It, to me, it had a lot of pagan kind of like old ways kind of ritualistic feel to it with the sounds of the drums and the black rabbit and the white wolf and the relationship between Lucifer and the dad, God, kind of made me think about more of a like Loki and Odin situation of, you know, that trickster kind of outcast dude who's, you know, messed up the family a little bit, but was still part of the pantheon and still connected to things and still grieved when his mother died and was a part of that. The stuff with like the put on the dresses for the thing too. I mean, because Thor and Loki several times pretended to be goddesses at weddings and things like that in order to sneak in and cause trouble. So to wear the fancy clothes and be a little bit out of place and something serious is happening, but there's that little bit of playfulness to it. It felt connected to like a Norse myth to me, but I think that there's that kind of thing in so many ancient religions. It could be Zeus and Hades. I think they were brothers, not father and son, but originally Hades was part of the upper world, and he got knocked down there, and Lucifer started off as an angel and became the devil later. So it's like he turned it into a dysfunctional family coming together over a death, but he did it in such, like, amazing descriptions. I loved the way that the things were described, the clothes, everything. Ben, this was phenomenal. It just, I mean, we talked about it for like 20 minutes, so clearly awesome. All right, here we go with one by Pam Ray. I'm going to play our SoundCloud from Pam. If I can find it here. Pam, here we go.
Magenta marionette. She's a magenta marionette floating in the blue waves of dreamscape facades, knuckles bruised against echoes. She longs to escape this prison of expectations and blind obedience. Beneath the horizon, she bleeds pigments into dutiful prayers of a daughter in bondage. Taut thread pulls the corners of her painted lips into a performance of smiles. She's dreaming of dark pink love poured upon the bobbing heads of wild violets, explosions of liquid fireworks. She's a velvet exterior holding in the laughter of cloud nymphs, struggling to free the dragon's wings from the scars she carries. Her soul craves to ride the storms and begin again in a land where magic speaks for itself.
Wonderful SoundCloud. Thanks, Pam, for including a SoundCloud. I always appreciate those. It's so nice to hear it read by the author. I loved this. The use of color was fantastic. You know, she's a magenta marionette floating in the blue waves of dreamscape facades. You know, just this magenta and blue, and you get this kind of painted landscape with this piece, especially with the bleeding, the pigments, into dutiful prayers of a daughter in bondage. You know, just really talking about how she's captive to expectations, you know, what you're supposed to do as a good daughter, as a good woman, as a, you know, the, you know, what you should and shouldn't do, things you can and can't say, and how it makes you kind of a puppet, you know, but to still have dreams of being something more than that, more expressive, you know, dreaming of dark pink love poured upon the bobbing heads of wild violets, explosions of liquid fireworks. There's just this desire to be more, the desire to be free, to just explode. You know, I really enjoyed it. You know, just the, you could feel the, that desire to want to be more than a marionette, you know, even at the expense of loss, you know, struggling to be free, the dragon's wings, struggling to free the dragon's wings from the scars she carries, you know, to release the dragon, to become the beast instead of the marionette, something powerful. So I really liked it. I thought it was really beautifully done and well expressed in color, Pam. I really liked this piece. Thank you. Tiziana, your thoughts?
My favorite part was the second stanza, knuckles bruised against echoes. I thought that was amazing because the idea of being bruised by something that isn't a physical thing. You know, you can be harmed by something that is not tactile, but bruise kind of shows that it's not just harmed, but it's harmed in a way that even though it's an internal harm, it ends up showing. So against the echoes, and then it talks about the prison of expectation. So those echoes could just be like, you know, that person's voice in the back of your mind telling you what you should be doing, there was this episode of some TV show where the grandmother had passed away, and they had like this diamond made out of her, which is something you can do, and they had it as a necklace, and every time she was wearing the necklace, she could hear the grandma, like, just in the back of her, like, she wasn't actually hearing it, but she just imagined the grandma being like, are you sure you should be eating that second cupcake, or I don't know about this boy, and so she was just like, she can't handle the echo of those expectations. So to be bruised by what you hear, what you're thinking about past things that people have said, it's just incredible how in those two little lines, just four words, she makes me think about a lot of things. So there's much more to say, but that, I'm just going to leave it at that. That stanza is brilliant. Pam, you're the best. Can you give Pam a little comment?
Yes, Madam Ray is magnificent, as always. But one of the things that for me is a theme about someone wanting to escape from the control that seems to be plaguing them. And I like everything that you just commented on, but one of the things that really struck me is how she keeps pushing everything to the next level, where certain things can just stand alone, and then right when you think, oh, it could stop right there, she puts this one other little rung on the ladder. For example, let me just pull this up. Like in the very beginning, it says she's a magenta marionette floating in the blue waves, and that could be sufficient right there. But what she's doing is she's just pushing it to the next level, because she's not just a magenta marionette floating in the blue waves. She takes it a step further by saying their blue waves are of a dreamscape facade, of dreamscape facades. It's not just blue waves, but suddenly these blue waves transcend into something else, in this case, dreamscape facades. And then she does it again, really clever, in the, fourth stanza. Beneath the horizons, she bleeds pigments. That could be enough right there. It could stop, but no, Pam takes it to a whole other level, because it's not just beneath the horizons where she bleeds pigments. Going one step further, those pigments are the pigments. Those pigments become dutiful prayers, and again, it could stop right there, but the dutiful prayers are that of a daughter in bondage. So that just, maybe the next one, taut thread pulls the corners of her painted lips. It could stop there, but she takes a step further by saying those painted lips, the taut thread that pulls the corners of those painted lips, they become a performance of smiles. And none of this feels forced either. It all feels very organic, and there's this kind of incredible continuation of it's almost like I'm trying to think of making a cake, and it has all these different layers, and
she does a really good job with progression. I agree.
She puts this sweet frosting on it.
She does.
Crazy good.
Oh, great comment. Where are we off to next?
Now we have Purple by Patty Mike. This is a brevity. I'll give it a read. Amethyst, boysenberry, eggplant, heather, iris, lilac, magenta, mulberry. Now, let's jam. End poem.
I thought this was a really fun brevity. You know, it's 11 words, which I think, you know, was from another contest because it's really emphasized in the AN. But I think it's fun. It's the listing of all these different things that are purple. Although I think it's interesting to think of magenta as a subset of purple, especially when you know it in the context of color theory. You know, magenta is actually closer to a primary color than red. It is a primary color, essentially, not red. So, but anyway, that's a much longer but then I love the now let's jam, because I just picture someone going, like, ham on a drum set, but I also picture, like, a jar of jam, which can also be purple, especially if it's, you know, made with boysenberries or, you know, some of these other items that are listed here. So I thought it was really clever and really fun, and it felt really upbeat. So thanks, Patty Mike. Bill, your thoughts?
Yeah, I was thinking as I was looking at this list, Patty Mike must not be anywhere near Minneapolis, because then he would have to include Purple Rain.
Prince.
That's a bad Prince joke, but it's kind of cool everything seems so disconnected, but when you have the title there with it, then it all makes perfect sense. And, that last line is very cute. Now let's jam. And with the mulberry coming just before that, I do think of it as jelly. But the writing itself is just peanut butter, which means it's thick and it's packed. And a little nutty, in the best kind of ways. Yeah, amazing. In 11 words, he's able to conjure all these images, and each one has its own intimations. You know, when you think of an amethyst, I know most people wouldn't just immediately think of the color, but they think of the crystal in itself. And that's the only thing there
on that list that I wouldn't necessarily want in a jam.
No,
if you knew about it ahead of time, maybe, and you could look for it.
It could be the jar.
I mean, have you ever... You might want to suck jam off the crystal amethyst. You know, that could be kind of fun. I've never sucked on any semi-precious stones, but I've never come across any buried in jam either. I might give it a try.
Depends if it's sharp or polished.
So again, all these things have something in common by the color, but yet each thing has a intimation of its own. Amethyst, eggplant, eggplants. Again, being of another generation, I only recently learned from my adult children that the eggplant emoji has this whole other meaning. That has nothing to do with vegetables. We don't have to get into that conversation.
Let's move on to the next prompt here.
I learned that, when I see the reference to eggplant, my mind can go in all kinds of different directions, and none of them involve a vegetable.
No. Okay, so we're going to get moving on here to more poetry. And
danger,
the quote
Robinson,
that I put...
Danger.
Yeah. The quote that I used as a prompt is, "All you have is your fire and the place you need to reach. Don't you ever tame your demons, but always keep them on a leash," which is from this song, Arsonist's Lullaby, by Hozier. And I was going to play the song, but you know what? I don't think we have much time. So I'm just going to move right into the poems. And there's one by Rick Six. Bill, would you read that for us, please?
Yeah, I'm coming right up. Here it is. Pyromaniac. Okay, this is Pyromaniac. When Michael was a small boy, he sat and watched the fire, safe on Daddy's lap, as the flames danced higher and higher. Feeling warm all over, rosy cheeks aglow, a sea of red-hot flames sparked a fever in his soul. Pyromaniac, they called him Firebug. Pyromaniac, the shrink said he needed love. On his eighth birthday, he found matches somewhere, and all alone in the living room, set fire to his daddy's chair. With a gleam in his eye and a great big grin, it was most disconcerting. Smolder, smoke, spark, and burn. And flames climbed up the curtain. Pyromaniac, they called him Firebug. Pyromaniac, the shrink said he needed love. One day, when he was 17, he went out for a walk. And with a can of gas and single match, burned down a city block. Now he sits alone in a padded cell, never ever feeling no pain. He's got a roaring, raging fire burning deep down in his brain, crackling, blazing. They had to cage him, his folks said. Our son is so sweet. He's got a scorching, burning, unnatural yearning, passion for the heat. Pyromaniac, they called him Firebug. Pyromaniac, the shrink said he needed love. The shrink said he needed love. All right, Rick Six. I'm hearing Beavis and Butthead, the character saying fire, 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 fire.
Yeah, I can see that. I really like this. I could hear the musical, lyrical quality to this. You know, and my sister was a little bit of a pyromaniac growing up. I'm not kidding. I didn't trust her to start the fire in the wood stove because she would run off with matches. She almost lit her house on fire a few times. She did light the neighbor's entire front yard on fire. So, yeah. But, you know, I could feel the musicality in this, you know. And I imagine if I listened to the song with it, I could hear the song, you know, with a gleam in his eye and a great big grin. It was most disconcerting. Smolder, smoke, spark, and burn. Flamers climbed up the curtain. You know, like, it's got the good rhythm to it. It's got a great rhyme scheme to it. It's got the repetition. It very much feels like lyrics, you know, this idea that the shrink just said he needed love. I think he had plenty of love. He was in love with the fire. He just wanted to watch it burn. And I don't think it was because he wasn't loved. It was just a separate kind of love. You know, sometimes pyromaniacs are just pyromaniacs. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I felt like it was really upbeat, very musical, very rhythmic, excellent rhyme scheme. And very on point theme. So well done, Rick Six. Still, like, a classic song to me. Abaziana, your thoughts?
I agree. It's rhythmic and musical. And having listened to the prompt song a few times recently, I could definitely see this working with the music of that song. I feel like he was probably listening to it as he wrote it. And there's quite a bit of at the beginning and the end of the song where it's just like, and they're humming, like getting ready for the song, kind of like setting the tone. And I can feel that working here with the Kraken blazing, had the Cajun. I can imagine that part with that humming in the background, and that he's got a roaring rage fire burning deep down in his brain. I love that. I love that even when he is locked up, he's still burning on the inside. That fire is not something that is like necessarily a literal fire. He has that fire in him. The fire is still a part of his psychosis, even when he can't play with it. I thought that part in the padded cell was really strong. And there's a pyromaniac in the song, so because we didn't listen to that, I should clarify, this is not coming out of nowhere. This is, like, very on prompt. Well done. Babbler, I'm going to get you to read the next one, please. Oh, yep. Sorry, Bill.
Yeah, I was just going to add a little something to what Rick Six did that I thought was so interesting. You know, he didn't go right to the pathological aspect of this kid. He set it up because in all the initial lines, you know, it's really seen as this almost innocent infatuation, not so much of a mental affliction, but just like a kid's typical curiosity. And maybe most of us can remember the first time we had a lighter or a pack of matches to ourselves and how cool it was to play with it, because it was always such a no-no, put that down. But that's just childish curiosity, and that's what it seems like very much it is in the beginning, and then suddenly it takes this very dark turn, but it doesn't take the turn until the kid sets his father's chair on fire, the same chair where he probably sat on his father's lap, and it's at that point when you go, wait a minute, this kid is really screwed up. Something dangerous going on here.
But even then, like, even though it gets dark, it never gets so dark that he's hurting people, you know? It's not his goal to hurt people. It's just the fire itself. It doesn't seem like there's a viciousness. And I think that is a statement, too, that as much as he loves the fire, it's not about hate. It's just about
pyromaniacs, they get such a bad rap. All they want to do is bring a little warmth into this cold world.
On that note, I was, do you want me to read the next one? I think it's my turn.
Yes, please, Babbler.
I believe you have a Righteousness by Ulugon. This is, here it goes. I besought an ancient way to destroy the wicked of the day, but in the end I destroyed them in the utmost of descent, because they've broken all that way good in the land. How are they not foam to simmer, to understand the world in which I glimmer, to see that I do not destined desire, the wicked in the light, demons a sire, but into the fire they have to go, washed sevenfold times in the dungeon of soul. They tell me I did wrong, but I say, where is the manuscript that tells you the way of fold? To have the demons on a leash so that I can manifold my way in the scene, the world of its reeling. But perchance I have already done so in the take of time, just unrealized it because I follow them every step of their crime. So will I rewind? To bring them into servitude, one can leash them into the senseless rude, to have them talk to be tainted of the bad in the bands. But if the leash is down to hell, if you have already broken them into the assail, what do then can they ever incel, but in their dead bodies, in the heartbeats that they corrupted before? So too will I leash them in the light of my score, so that they will never again do their wickedness encore. Because I have fought for heaven on earth in the war and settled the score, so I will not be the one out the door, so that the demons understand I am at the shore where light shines and no more demons roar the sore, giving you the heaven and its door, lifting shore. End poem.
Great read, Babbler. Thank you. I love the language that he uses. If I'm not mistaken, we learned before that English is not M. Tsai's first language. I could be mixing him up with someone. But he has a really good grasp of vocabulary for ESL, like even for not ESL, to use words like perchance, gives it this old-fashioned kind of feeling. And the one thing that I know M. Tsai is kind of known for is the capitalizations, although he's toned it down this one compared to sometimes, but he does still point out certain words to be emphasized, like broken is capitalized, and settled the score is emphasized. So you can't help but notice those words that are important to the story. So if you're physically reading it, not just listening, there are some words that are really emphasized. And I think Babbler handled that well in her read. So very interesting. Thank you, M. Tsai. And Bill, can you give us just a quick comment? We're almost out of time, and I want to squeeze one more in.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'll try to keep it quick. And if it's true that English is a second language, what a command of vocabulary this guy has. And the vocabulary is fine, but the only thing that really strikes me is I'm looking at the structure. And to me, it almost seems more like, even though with your read, it's very poetic, but to see it on paper or on my screen here, it almost looks more like prose with a rhyme scheme added to it, more prosy than poetry for me. But, I sense the other, there's a duality in this. Because on one hand, it's called righteousness, and it starts off by talking about how someone, was trying to, be bestowed with this ancient paradigm, which may have been based in goodness, but their way of attacking the wicked of the day was very dirty and underhanded. So they end up maybe becoming something which is very opposite than what they wanted to be, and tried to rationalize it because as if to say, those wicked deserved everything they got coming to them, which I guess is an often state of mind for those who try to promote their righteousness. The ends justify the means, that type of thing. It's a great story and great language, and that's all. I'll move on.
Great comment. Thank you.
I thought it was interesting that you commented on how it seems like prose, because this author has a tendency to write in large paragraphs, and this poem, unlike most of the writes I see from them, have line breaks, which I found fascinating, because usually there aren't line breaks, so I'm not sure what inspired that. But I agree with you mostly on what you thought it was about as well, it being about wiping out the wicked of the land, but kind of going overboard to the point where you wiped out not just the bad, but the good too, you know, clean slate, and to call yourself righteous when you've killed everything in the name of clearing out evil. You've cleared out also all the good, and whether or not that is righteous, whether that is the right thing to do or if that is evil in itself. So, excellent comment. And I enjoyed this piece. It was very powerful, and very thematic. You know, I enjoyed it. Thank you. And Sai, Ladon.
Sounds like my immune system. It's like, oh no, there's a germ. Let's just destroy all your organs. So here we go with one by G.A. Grimm called Embers. And we have a SoundCloud, which is exciting because I love his SoundClouds. There we go.
King Me by G.A. Grimm. I am a bird with a clipped wing, a yo-yo without a string, a bell that does not ding, a jack, a pop,
oh no, this
but
is
no
the
string.
Wrong one.
I am a phone that won't ring.
Yeah, I'm looking
for just some bee missing a sting.
No, this is the wrong one. Oh, you know what? He wrote to several of my contests. Let's look.
Mm-hmm. so there may be more
okay.
than one.
I have more than one for him, so I'm going to put up the one that we have an audio for, even though that's for the other contest, just because we have an audio. Let's do the audio. I'm going to restart the audio now that I've put the proper words on the board.
King Me by G.A. Grimm. I am a bird with a clipped wing, a yo-yo without a string, a bell that does not ding, a jack, a box, but no spring. I am a phone that won't ring, just some bee missing a sting, the guilt without the fling, a song that no one can sing. I am static, sans the queen, and all else she might bring, for I alone am the king of every last broken thing.
Great audio. I love his audios. I also really love this poem. It's a brevity, but it feels so very sad because it is a listing of broken things. But the rhyme is consistent. Like, it's the same end rhyme throughout. I think, some of my favorite ones in here, just to pick a couple, are a jack, a box, and no spring, you know, because it's just like a doll in a box. It's kind of sad and depressing, but I think that's the intended feeling, you know, the king of broken things, right? I also really liked the line, the guilt without the fling, you know, to like feel guilty about a one-night stand that never happened, you know, a wild night that didn't occur, and to feel all the negativity and remorse of that and never have actually experienced the evening, I thought was a really interesting piece in here. I think this does a really great job of feeling wistfully melancholy, you know, the king of broken thing. It's sad, and yet in a way beautiful as well. It reminds me of like a crow collecting all of the little tidbits of trash because they're shiny. G.A. Grimm, I really enjoyed it.
I loved it. Oh, sorry. Yep. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I had pulled up the wrong poem apparently, because I thought I was looking at Embers, but then when I heard the SoundCloud, I realized the link wasn't the same as what was playing, and I might be interpreting all this wrong because I'm not looking at the words right in front of me. I'm only recalling what I listened to. But what I got from it, and I could be looking at this all wrong again, but, was that even though all these things sound like a terrible state to be in, he's king. You know, so it's not like he's, you know, he says that he's the phone that doesn't ring, you know, a song that doesn't sing, which would seem very lonely and small and significant almost. But then he's king. And I almost get a sense that I can be all of these things and I'm okay with it. It's fine because I'm still this. You know, I didn't necessarily see it all as sad and tragic. I found tones of acceptance too. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's neat that someone can weave two very different ideals into one writing, or write it such that one person would find it. I'm sorry. Let me shut up.
It's okay. I was just saying, great observation. I like that. I like that you have a brighter interpretation of it than I did. Excellent comment.
I'm somewhere between. Yeah, I think that you're both right. I'm mostly saddened by it, but I also saw a few places where I think that the thing missing the thing in some ways is better. As sad as it is to be the bird with the clipped wing, it's the one who stays. As sad as it is to be the jack in the box with no spring, he doesn't scare you. To be the bee without the stinger, you know, he may not feel as tough, but I mean, once a bee stings, they die. A bee who's just making honey and is not stinging people, it will be more loved. So sometimes when you take away the piece that you think that you need to have, you're still worthy. And in his own way, he is the king of what he considers maybe to be the broken things, but in a valuable way. As Babbler, even when you were saying, like, the crow gathers all the little things and one man's trash is another man's treasure, well, maybe G.A. Grimm can see the treasure within the things that are incomplete, because he feels incomplete himself, and that ends up giving him more value because he appreciates those things. I thought this was beautiful. I love that he gave us a SoundCloud. People, please make me SoundClouds. Even if your voice is not as beautiful as George's, because I actually think he's amazing at SoundClouds. And he can sing, too. If you haven't heard him sing, you gotta go to his SoundCloud and hear him sing. Because he says he can't, but he can. Really good. Thank you, George. And I'm actually going to read Embers, which was the one that was for the contest that we were talking about, because the one that we just listened to was for my other contest, the one about darkness. Okay, so Embers. This is by G.A. Grimm again. The bellows expel breath, a last defiance, before falling still. Still falling, down, burning low, the flame no longer dances, fading fast, fast fading. Away dreams stolen, happiness lost, never to come again, only leaving, leaving only. Fear incontaminates everything. It contaminates everything, changing all into broken things. Things broken in me was once beauty treasured, cherished, now forever lost. Lost forever. End poem. So I'm just going to jump right in comment, even though I know it's Babbler's turn. I think that it's really cool that this one, again, is commenting on broken things. And I love the way that he reverses words and makes it still work. So the last line of, I think, each stanza gets repeated again in between stanzas, but switched around. Falling still becomes still falling. Fading fast becomes fast fading. Only leaving, leaving only. Broken things are things broken. And they all work in both directions with slightly different meanings. I really love that style. I don't know if it's actually an official poetry style. I'm curious if that's something that he's emulating or if it's just his own creativity, but I love it. And I think it works really nice having those little lines in between the stanzas. It gives you that pause to think about what just happened. I like spacing in poetry because of that. That breath when I'm reading it out loud, like on the radio here, and also that pause to think about it when I'm reading it just in my mind. So I appreciate that. Thank you, George. Babbler, what did you think?
I really enjoyed this. I mean, it is funny that it again has to do with broken things again. You know, they're very linked, these two poems. But, you know, just about cells and the way that they're fading, the way that they're temporary, that it's all, you know, everything will become broken because everything changes, you know, and that you can't have those things back. You know, what once, you know, a raging fire is consuming, that's what it does. And that's what makes me think of the reversed words that you were talking about. I love those, and it makes me want to read the poem backwards, because things keep bouncing back and forth. I wondered what does it sound like if I read it from bottom to top instead, you know, and it's just as beautiful backwards, honestly. You know, lost forever, forever lost, now treasures cherished was once beauty in me. Things broken, broken things into changing all, if it contaminates everything. Fear, leaving only, only leaving. It works beautifully, just as well. You know, especially that first stanza, falling still before a last defiance, expel breath, the bellows. That last final breath. So I loved this piece. I thought it was really gorgeous. And then about, you know, how life changes, how things are temporary, you know, and all things become broken things. And there's beauty in that because they were used, they lived, you know, they were. So, wonderful, right? Really enjoyed it. And Bill, you want to give us your thoughts?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you mentioned earlier about the spacing. I too agree. I think the way that the spacing helps accentuate the line that is between those empty spaces, so it makes it pop out. I will have to comment on one other thing that really struck me, because I stumbled onto this years ago, and you know, sometimes there's some things you might see, and once you see, you'll never unsee it. It sticks with you. I don't know if anyone can see the picture that falls between the title, Embers, and the lines. Do you see that?
There's
an image. That image is something that comes from the birds of Midway. And if you're not familiar with that, it's a so out in the Pacific on the island of Midway, for some reason, because of its location in the ocean, every little bit of garbage and plastic kind of refuse and bottle tops, lighters, box cutters, all of this garbage just ends up on the shores and coastline of this island. And the birds, when they see it, they see this bit of trash, they eat it, not knowing what they're eating. And then when they have babies, of course, the mother bird, you know, feeds the baby bird through the mouth. So the birds that have consumed all this trash, they end up feeding it to their children. And the birds, as they mature, they become bogged down in their own weight, with a stomach full of this plastic caps and razors or whatever garbage, lighters, whatever garbage that they found, and they end up dying. But when they die, all you see is this outline of feathers, and everything decomposes,
except the trash that was in their stomach. It's such a horrendous thing to see. And
wow.
I've thought of that for years because it's like what people do with their words. They just throw it out like so much garbage so that it can get consumed by others. And we take those words in and it ends up killing us. You know, we don't die by what we hear. We die by what we take within. And that's the image that I see in this poem. And yes, you can read it backwards and it works perfectly. Matter of fact, he could have written the whole thing backwards and it would have been fine.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think of what that image represents, the lines all go appropriately with what happens at Midway as well. Thank you for letting me share that.
Yeah, thank you. It's easy on us. I know you don't have a lot of time, but thoughts real quick?
I thought it was amazing, and I will write him a long comment when I judge the contest. So we only have 30 seconds left. So thank you so much, Bill, for calling. Thank you, Babbler, for your wonderful comments, too. Thank you to everyone who wrote into the contest and gave us permission to be on the show. We have about 16 carryovers, which is wonderful. That means we have a full show already for next week. But keep an eye on allpoetry.com for Aphasiana and Babbler's contests, because both of us basically always have contests on the go to be on our future shows. So if you want to be on for a few weeks from now, then please enter our contest. I'm going to be away next week, but Pam Ray and Jeremy are going to fill in for me, so Babbler will have company. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you. Night.
Well, thank you.